Hi. Yeah, we're back. Let's go. Yeah, he said we put the glasses at the same time, Spence. Bro, it's
Power.
energy. The
It's a
power.
power. Batman and Robin.
The greatest combination since Batman and Robin. Anyway, let's start. Dream it, believe it, become it.
Come on down. And we're joking when we're saying coming on down today because
Right.
like it's a hype one. And I'm saying like for one of the guys who has been a legend of British boxing.
Legend.
Right? And one of the most technical fighters that this country has ever produced. Right? And if I had a young fighter, I would say he was British boxing's equivalent to Ricardo Lopez. When we look at technical style, yeah, go on
That
to
ain't
it.
a lie. That ain't a lie. Because
All
you know, Lopez is my man. And I've been watching Duke from back in the day. Because, but over the last couple of nights, I've been really going back and watching Duke's career. And this guy, everything that you would want from a fighter, technically, Duke displayed that.
1
Everything.
million percent and more, Twin. I would say and more.
Yes, yes.
And more. The way how Duke would catch shot, how he would throw four jabs at a time.
Back, 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 back,
Yeah,
back, back. Turn off
his,
the side.
yeah, come
Oh,
on, man.
man.
His consistency, his honesty to the game of boxing. This guy, trust me, absolutely fantastic fighter and not given the dues. Now you have to remember, he was British boxing's first freeweight world champion,
Imagine,
right?
imagine. And just to cut you there, it's like he's been that generation has been wiped off.
Yeah,
And the great man said, if you don't know your history, you don't know your future.
exactly.
So,
And
you
if you don't know if you don't know your history, you're like a tree without roots.
know. Yes, that's Marcus Garvey. I know
All right, yeah.
that.
Big
That's
up yourself,
what
Tunde.
I know
Big
about
up yourself.
Marcus. I'm an honorary Jamal, Jamaican, so
Yeah,
don't worry about that.
of course you are. Of course you are. Just
I
like
expect
I'm honorary Niger, because if you look on my toes, I've got black toenails. It's all good.
All right, Spence, I've got a little surprise for you this evening.
All right.
Yeah, watch this now. Gary, before we bring in the one and only Duke McKenzie MBE, play the tape, please.
Obviously, emotion still running high there in the corner. Lloyd Hannigan giving his congratulations as well. Very happy scenes, Charlie, aren't they?
That's right, it is happy scenes there. There's all his brothers in the ring. Duke McKenzie can't even get his senses here. I think he's giving a little cry.
Huh?
Ready? Ready, let's go.
I'd go around there.
Right, Harry, I think, is with the new champion
now. Congratulations, that was a tremendous performance. Are you all right? Can you talk to me? You're overwhelmed, I know what it's What can you say to me?
Oh,
Eh?
no,
That was an amazing performance.
Jesus
You took the guy
Christ.
apart. You absolutely took him apart.
It's,
Come on, you took him apart. You took him
it's just been
apart.
a long time coming,
You
Harry.
waited a long time, that's right.
We
Been a
waited a
night.
long time.
The night's here and you've done it.
Yeah.
It was tremendous.
Yeah, they done it in style,
I
Harry.
can't believe
Done
it.
it in style.
Tell me about how did you plan it? What was the plan?
There was no fun. I just knew I had to go with him, Harry.
But you
In
boxed him
there.
so well in the early stages, you
He
never let
was so
anything in.
strong. I thought he was going to knock me out.
Sure, come on, come on, come on.
He was never going to knock you out, my son.
Yeah.
He always kept him out. But what a finish. What do you think of that finish you just put in there?
That was brilliant. That was brilliant.
I can't stop.
Duke, the champion. Well done, congratulations. And Charlie Magri told me to congratulate you. So that was great. Duke, thanks very much.
God almighty, Spence! You know when you used to go dance and you play the dub plate and it just Spence, that was serious, isn't it?
That was very, very serious and very, very touching.
Oh my God.
I actually was at that fight, you know.
You, who's that fight?
I was at that fight. I was at that fight. You know what I mean? I was at that fight. What was that? I think that was October 5th, 1988. Go check. Am I right?
The knowledge, it was. Hold on. October 5th, 1998. The knowledge does it again. Anyway, without further ado, let me introduce to the Fight Is Right watchers, viewers, and listeners, the one, the only, the one known as the little man, the ever humble, ever gracious, one and only, Mr. Duke McKenzie, MBE.
How you doing, Spence? Good to see you guys.
How you doing, mate?
Yeah, really good, thanks, champ. Really good. Really well.
Spence, I'm excited.
Dude, I recognize you now. It's like you've ate the old Duke McKenzie.
Huh? So, Spence, again?
It's like you've ate the old Duke McKenzie. That belly's looking good.
I've joined. Listen, this is my walking round weight now, so I can eat what I want. I drink what I want. I'm comfortable. I'm so happy. I'm ridiculously happy. It's stupid. I've always been in a good place.
I can see in the background there, you've got your WBO belt, I believe. That's a WBO belt.
That's my WBO Bantamweight World Title belt. I just thought it looked good for a little bit of the backdrop.
Where's the IBF belt? Go and get it. The IBF belt, because that was where you were. Rodolfo Boja.
Yeah,
that was when you boxed excellently in that fight.
That was listen, I've had a career that really I could only really have dreamt about. And you know, when I started off in boxing, my dream was never to become a world champion. That was always my brother's dream. Dudley'd always set me up. Dudley'd always said to me, you know, you've got greatness within you. You're going to smash this. And by smash it, he didn't mean, you know, become a world champion straight away. But Dudley had so much confidence in me. Dudley filled me with confidence. I mean, listen, everybody needs somebody, right? Dudley's my older brother by 18 months. And like I say, without his sort of love and support, really, I wouldn't be the person that I am today. So, I mean, listen, all that I am and what I'll ever be owed to my brother, Dudley, specifically. Like, I've got five other brothers who I love dearly. But there was just saying about Dudley. Me and Dudley, we were more than brothers.
Yeah, God bless you. Dudley passed away, right?
Yes, listen, in 95, I lost my brother to a suicide. And, my life has never been the same since. There's not really a lot I can say about Dudley that really... You see, this is another reason why I've stopped... See, I've been trying to write a book for the last couple of years. And because Dudley played such a big part of my life and was in my life for such a long time, I have to keep putting it down because I can't finish it because I just can't find the words to do him justice. Do you see what I mean? And it's very, very difficult for me to get over certain periods, certain things that were going on in my life with Dudley, in and around, you know, together. Like I say, I've never known anybody in my whole life. This includes my coach, Colin Smith, Mickey Duff, my manager, people that know and people that really love me. Nobody loved me more than my brother Dudley. And when I won in world title fights, Dudley won with me. When I lost in world title fights, Dudley lost with me. And like I say, when I used to melt down, have a breakdown and would be scratching my head, my brother was always there to lift me up. But he took so much of me on board, really, probably too much. Do you see what I mean? So, like I say, my whole me, who I am, what I am, what I do, everything that I've ever achieved, I really have to put it down to, you know, my peers and role models that I had in my life. And Dudley played such a massive part of my life. And really, I've never had another relationship like that with another man before. I've got five other brothers, as I said, that I love dearly. But Dudley, like I said, we're more than brothers. So I can't really put it any more simple than that.
You know, it seems that recently, you know, there's a big drive about the mental health situation and people are becoming more open, you know, and speaking about it. And like, how do you feel about that? Like, you feel that it's a good thing that's happened, you know, having a brother, you know, losing a brother to suicide. What's your thoughts on the current day, you know, every, you know, the mental health, and I guess Tyson Fury has made it, you know, something to talk about. But I hear a lot of, especially young people now, you know, coming out and speaking about the problems they've had or are having. What's your take on that, Duke?
Well, you know, since the loss of my brother, it's made me be a lot more probably, I don't know if sympathetic is the right word, but certainly a lot more sort of compassionate towards just my everyday man, really. And I am an ambassador for the mental health organisation Mind, and I try to, I don't know if educate is the right word, but I just listen to people. That's my, if you, for the want of a better word, that's my gift. I'm a good listener. I love to talk and I love to listen. And I've been working with Mind for about sort of 15 years on and off, working with people specifically with mental health problems. People have been in and out of mental health hospitals, like the Bethlehem, which is the second biggest mental health institution in the country. I get groups, I used to get people, groups of up to 10 people that come directly out of the hospital to come and use my gym as a way of like rehabilitation, if you will, back into the real world. And, you know, boxing for me has given me such a great life. It's given me such a good purpose. And I just really hope that, I mean, I believe all boxers are a little bit touched in one way or another. Yeah. And I just think that everybody walks a fine line. Because, you know, believe it or not, from four-round fighters to 12-round championship fighters, when you go home and the fight's over, win, lose, or draw, there's questions to be asked. And if you don't ask the questions and you haven't got the answers for these questions, then sometimes there's more questions than answers, don't they? And it can be a real troublesome period for anybody at any walk of life. And if you're not making it and you're not getting the breaks that you want, you become frustrated. And Spencer, you'll know because you've done it. So it's a very, very fine line that boxers walk. Boxers are like thoroughbred racehorses. They've got to be treated with kitty gloves, and you have to know when to shout at them and when not to shout at them. And yeah, when, you know, when to arm around them and when not to. And for me, there's not enough teachers out there now.
Yeah.
I'd like to say, Duke, probably touch on mental health. I think before Tyson Fury, the one that really highlighted the mental health issues was actually your nephew, Leon McKenzie, former heavyweight champ. And Leon highlighted Leon highlighted in a way, like, so what was the support system that you offered to Leon when he was going through everything? Because I remember Leon as a footballer, right, being on like GMTV doing kick-ups in a pair of Gucci loafers, right?
Yeah.
Right, and like I'm saying, wow, that's Clinton's son, you know? Because yeah. I remember Leon the night you won the world title against Borja, and I didn't even know it was Leon. It was only now that we're talking about it. And I said, yeah, because I remember seeing your brother Clinton with some little curly and high colour.
That's it, yeah. Listen, I've always been Uncle Duke, and he still calls me that to this day. Leon's 40 years old now. I'm always, but he still calls me Uncle, which I love him for. And I haven't, listen, all I've had to be to Leon is an uncle. And I think I've done a decent job being an uncle. You know, I call him up regularly, I talk to Leon all the time. And that's the way, we've always been reasonably close. But see, what Leon's always had in his life, he's had a fatherly presence. So while Leon was going through all of his chaos and all of his madness and divorce and, you know, the breakup maybe in his life and the football breaking down and everything else, he's always had his dad to fall back on. And fortunately for Leon, you know, they're very, very close, and they've got a beautiful relationship. They really have. I mean, Clinton, my older brother, as you know, Clinton was like my dad. Clinton always showed me love growing up. Clinton would be the first one to, you know, the highlight for me on a Friday when I was about 4 or 5 years old, I'd get home from school, Spencer and Tunda, I'd get home from school, and the highlight for me was I couldn't wait to get in and have a bath, put on my best pair of short trousers, I put on my best pair of flip-flops, my best pair of plimsolls, and a white T-shirt I always used to wear. I only had two in those days. And my brother Clint would walk me to the shop. It was called Chapman's Sweet Shop at the bottom of South Norwood Hill. And we'd walk there. Take us about, I'm not joking, what should have took us probably about, on a good day, you could walk there in 5 minutes. It took us about an hour. because we would just take it step by step by step. It was always sunny. It was always shining. Sun was always shining. And Kit would walk me to this shop, buy me a strawberry mousse, buy the boxing newspaper, and we would read it, front page to back page, coming back. It was like the highlight of my week. I couldn't wait to walk down the street with my older brother because he'd like hold my hand and, you know, like I said, buy me a strawberry mousse. And I thought I was like Johnny Big Bollocks. I'd arrived because I had a boxing news, and it was, you know what? They were like the early 70s, and we had such a special upbringing because down our street there were so many families. There was like the Kennedy families, the Mackenzies, I think there was like a Watson family. There was the Marx family, but everybody had like sort of 10, 15 kids in their families. And we would all just go out and play football, or we'd always go out and do something as these communities, because that's what we were then. You know, everybody would just like come together. We used to go down a local park, which was Tennyson Park in South Norwood. We'd go down there. My dad just kick us out in the morning from 8 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night. We was out all day just playing football. And my brothers would do shadow boxing in the park, but the time went like that. From the minute we got up to the minute we got out, we was only allowed to come back for an hour in the afternoon, get a bit of lunch, like beans on toast and sugar and water, because we couldn't afford orange juice or Coca-Cola. Yeah, sugar and water all day long. And but the community was just great growing up. It really was. And I miss those times.
All right, so before we touch on, I mean, listen, I think that was a wonderful way to start off the show, Spence and Duke, you know, highlighting the mental health. And it's not nothing we planned for, but I'm so glad we did start it off like this. But, you know, we're here to discuss you, your illustrious, wonderful career. And obviously, we started at the top of the show with showing you that night against Rolando Boho and winning that, you know, that flyweight title. I want to take you back down memory lane, Duke. Let's tell us how you felt, because you know, before that, what we didn't show is when you dropped him in the 11th round and Harry Carver went, done him, mate. Yeah, that was the highlight of the whole thing for me. The way Harry Carver said, done him, you know, because the guy was, as you said, the guy was a tough guy. And, you know, when I heard your words at the end and you said, you know, the guy was so strong. You know, that probably was the first Manny Pacquiao, because he was from the Philippines.
Well, his trainer was a guy called Flash Ilorde. He was the first, I believe, Filipino world champion. And what you find with a lot of the Philippine guys, or a lot of guys from that, you know, from that side of the world, they're always short, stocky. I mean, when I looked at him with the weigh-in, he had muscles coming out of his ears. And he was just looking me up and down. He speaks all in English, but I knew what he was thinking, and he knew what I was thinking. And right then and there, at the weigh-in, I can remember I broke out in a cold sweat because I was weighing him up in my mind, thinking, this is what I was saying to myself. This is at the weigh-in. I said to myself, I can't beat this guy. And Dudley was standing right behind me, and I swear to God, as I live and breathe, my brother just leaned over my shoulder, and he whispered in my ear, and he said to me, little man, he said to me, there's nothing to fear except fear itself. And right then and there, I don't know what it was, but I had to stand up and be counting. So I looked at him back and I stared him out and one thing and another. But I kept doubting myself. This is like on fight day. I'm like doubting myself. So I've gone back to the hotel with my coach and Dudley. And, you know, Dudley just spoke to me for the whole afternoon. Even when I was trying to sleep and lay down, my brother just kept talking to me, telling me how I was going to win the fight and how he was going to break this guy down. And, you know, we planned on breaking it down in quarters, like from 1 to 4, 4 to 8, and 8 to 12. You know, the first four rounds of the Boho fight, if you watch it closely, the plan was I was just going to run like a thief in the night, and because I didn't want to get hit. I mean, those gloves that we wore on fight night, they weren't 8 ounce gloves, they were 6 ounce gloves. I've still got them to this day. Now, they were 6 ounce SDI gloves. And when he threw his first shot, I just felt the wind go past my chin. It went whoosh, and it missed me literally by a whisker. And I just kept saying to myself, I can't get nailed early. And if you watch the fight, Spence, and if you watch it Tunde, like you said you did earlier, if you watch the fight, for the first two rounds, I run like a thief in the night. But at the beginning of the third round, I get so fed up with running I say to myself, I've got to test this guy. And I stopped running and I tested him. And he literally just walks onto a straight 1-2. Now, the fact that I've made contact gives me a little bit of confidence to try it again. So now I might have lost the first two rounds, but I definitely win the third round. And each round thereafter, I'm just pacing myself. Do you see what I mean? But all I say to myself is, if he throws one, I'm going to throw two. If he throws two, I'm going to throw three. I just kept saying, it was like a numbers game. And I just wanted to try and just keep myself ahead in the fight, at least in my own mind. And if you watch the fight closely, between rounds, when the camera comes back to my my corner, I'm talking to my coach because I'm not even conscious of what round it is. I say to Colin, yes, what round is it? Because I'm just talking to myself constantly. Good fight, McKenzie. Get up. Another good round, McKenzie. I just, Mickey Duckett says to me, put them in the bank. Each round, just keep banking it, banking it, banking it. And when we got to the beginning of the eighth round, and I'm saying to myself, I've got four more rounds to complete. Even if I lose, even if I get knocked out, all I kept saying to myself was, I've come this far. And that gave me confidence to go that little step further. It's very, very hard to, I don't even know what the right word is or how to explain it properly, but when you win a world title fight, even though you're ranked number one in the world, you still got questions to be asked because, you know, when I look back on my career, at each of my sort of championship fights that I had, and I mean, it started in 1982 with Danny Flynn winning the British Flyweight Championship. I'm going to get this. I'm just sort of taking the journey, Spence, on how I got to the Bahola fight. The Flynn fight was about building confidence, really. He was so petrified on fight day, as I was, but the difference between me and him was I didn't show it. Do you see what I mean? So when I beat Danny Flynn for the British Championship, which was my dream when I did start boxing, was to become British champion, to emulate my older brother Clinton, who was already British champion. I did that and I thought to myself, okay, now I've got something, because now I've got a Lonsdale belt, because that's what I wanted. Moreover, because Clint had the Lonsdale belt, so I got that. Then when I got nominated to fight Charlie Magri for the European title, I didn't know what I had. I knew I had something, but I didn't know what. Do you see what I mean? But I knew I was going to find out when I boxed Magri, because Magri was former world champion, as you know. He just regained the European title from Franco Cerchi in Italy. And
Charlie Magri was a monster. Charlie Magri was the favourite going into that fight with you. You do realise that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I still think that a lot of the press, and there was a lot of the public particularly, despised me, or certainly took a dislike to me when I beat Charlie at that time, because Charlie Magri at that time was what Frank Bruno was to the heavyweight division. Everybody loved Charlie. He was like Champagne Charlie. He was on the top, yeah, you know, when he was actually at the top.
It's funny that you just mentioned, you know, the game plan for the first, you know, the first part of the Bahola fight, because that's how I saw, because I watched the Magri fight last night again. And Magri come out like a bull in a china shop.
Yeah.
And you were just sidestepping, moving, running like a thief. And yeah, I said to Spencer, this is how I know boxing, because in the third round, you caught him with a up hook. And I said to myself, being the first time I watched the fight, I said, he's going to knock him out with a left hook. So when the left hook coming in the double deuce, I call it a double. Double deuce. Well, clap him down. I said,
like I say, you know, the Magri fight for me is what I call a coming of age fight, because he was a former world champion. He regained the European title against all the odds in Italy, and it was almost like a world title eliminator, because after winning the European title from Charlie Magri, I then got a genuine sort of world ranking. I think they put me in at about number seven, I think, at my first official world rating. And then I had a European title defense. I went to Italy and I defended against you.
Duke.
Pardon me?
That's when you ended into the WBC rankings. I can remember that.
That's right. I beat Pinner. I beat Jim Piano Pinner in Italy in his backyard. And that's another story. That's another mad, mad experience. But anyway, I got that. And now all of a sudden, I'm ranked like number one in the world to fight Sot Chitalada for the WBC title. And Chitalada, I don't blame him, because Mickey Duff tried to do a number on him, get him over here in the winter when it was cold. He'd never been outside of Thailand. And, you know, we was trying to get him over here, and but he wouldn't have it. And, I don't blame him, because I was very much on the ascendancy then. And then Mickey Duff switched his attentions to the IBF. And then this is, so by the time the Bahol fight came around, I was more than ready for it, if you see what I mean. But I didn't really know what I had, because my confidence wasn't where it was supposed to be. And so my brother put enough confidence in me and helped me to believe in myself. And like I say, when I started to break the fight down, I was gaining confidence, because from 1 to 4, end of the fourth round, I was still there. So from 4 to 8, I'm still there. I haven't been knocked out, and I haven't got a mark on me. And fortunately for me, Bahol was 5'5", I'm 5'7", so I had a bit of a height and reach advantage. Yes. And once I started to pick him up with the jab, everything just started to flow quite nicely. And he, you know, if you look at most of my early fights, certainly as a flyweight, I was a fair body puncher. I stopped Danny Flynn with a body shot. I got Magri with a body shot. And I kept chipping away at Bahol. And ultimately, I get in with a really decent sort of, it's like a right sort of uppercut to his left elbow at the beginning of the 10th round. I can hear him sucking up air badly. And that just gave me more confidence. And I just went after him after that. And the rest is history.
Right. So moving forward. Now, I mean, suppose you wanted to talk about the Danny Flynn fight.
I wanted to talk about the Danny Flynn fight.
Yeah, because
there were some good guys on that on the under, like on the undercard. Like,
yeah,
I remember Michael Watson was on that.
Sure.
Yeah, Michael, because Michael Watson was signed with Mickey Duff at the time. Yeah, that's Michael right. Watson on there, and like there was big talk about this Michael Watson. You,
yeah,
like at that time there, what was it like? Being in the gyms, how things were. I mean, like recently, we just on Friday just gone. The great Hugh Roy Curry, and I'm calling him the great because he held a British title, and nobody did nothing. And I remember, like, you wrote something really nice on our page. What were your memories like of the camaraderie that you had with all the fighters, especially Hugh Roy Curry, who just passed away? I know his family. You know,
Boy, when I say it was special times training, it was special times training. Now, like every Sunday when we used to train at the Old Kent Road Thomas Abeke gym, and Sunday was always sparring day for everybody. Everybody sparred on a Sunday. But the camaraderie that we had there, you know, for the late Hugh Roy Curry was just an absolute gentleman. One of the funniest guys, I'm telling you, if you knew him, I mean, well, I don't know how well you do know him, but he was one of the nicest, one of the funniest, one of the happiest people in boxing. And Hugh always had a story to tell. And, you know, he had this really sort of broad Jamaican accent. Well, he didn't really. He used to put it on, but it was great because, yeah, I'm telling you, it was great. Hugh would always have this way and in the gym. And he was just there to support everybody. I mean, in the gym on the Sunday, there were people like, I made a list, right? So there was guys like Billy Rusker, Ivory the Engine Jones, Tim Driscoll, Charlie Coke, Casey McCallum, Hugh Roy Curry, Prince Rodney, Vernon Van Riel, Errol Christie, the late Errol Christie. Oh, fellas, I need to, I need to plug my machine and I'm going to go off.
Yeah.
Can I just, sorry.
It's live. This is live. Yeah, you see what their names he's calling. You
serious?
Vernon Van Riel, yeah? He was a lightweight. I don't know how that guy ever won a British title. Vernon Van Riel would come into the York Hall, have a top hat on, yeah, when he'd fight. And he would take his... In fact, Vernon Van Riel was the first British fighter to come into the ring with his own entrance music.
Oh, wow.
Sorry.
Right? So we're talking like 83, 84. And Vernon Van Riel, remember he used to go with him? He used to have a top hat. He's coming with a top hat. And you throw the top hat and it would go all the way around New York Hall.
That's it. Listen, Vernon the Entertainer Van Riel. And like, so you'd be in the gym and I can remember being on a bag specifically. And Vernon would be on a bag next to me, but he'd stop doing what he was doing to come and hold the bag for me. And he'd almost coach me sometimes. As did Hugh Roy. Everybody had time for everybody when we was in the gym. We learned so much from one another, and we just learned how to be, you know, for the want of a better word, boxing brothers. you know, I couldn't wait to get to the gym at any day, to be honest with you. Because like I say, the guys that were down there, there was always somebody you could learn from. And back then, the sparring, if you ever saw El Christie and Prince Rodney sparring, I'm telling you.
Listen.
It would have been as good as a world title fight today.
Wow. Listen, can you tell people just how good Prince Rodney was?
If Prince Rodney was fighting today, Prince Rodney, no shadow of a doubt, Prince Rodney would be world champion today. If he was fighting today, judging by today's standards, boxing today isn't specifically like how I know it. You know, it's not really like how I know it. It's not. It's changed a lot. I'm talking about proper old school, you know, feinting, slipping, blocking, you know, stepping, turning guys onto shots, stepping on their toe, hitting them with a shot. Prince Rodney had every punch in the book. Prince Rodney's probably the only person I've ever seen spar with Errol Christie and hold his own. I mean, I see Errol spar with a lot of guys and, you know, absolutely destroy guys in sparring because he was just that good. Errol was on another level. But Prince Rodney would more than hold his own. Bearing in mind, Prince was a light middleweight. And if he was, I mean, he'd probably walk around at middleweight, but then that meant that Christie was a light heavyweight. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
But you'd pay to watch it. Those guys were just, very, you know, I'd say very, very special times for me, certainly.
So, Jimmy, were you present when, I think it was 1988, when it was Errol Christie sparred with Chris Eubank. Was you present at that spar?
Yeah.
On a Sunday. I was there, you know. I was there. And you know what? Dean Powell, God rest his soul, because Dean used to work at the Thomas & Beckett then, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so Dean used to kind of manage the gym, take care of him. He was like the caretaker. And
He was. I mean, like I say, if you saw Errol Christie sparring with anybody, you knew it didn't matter what you were doing, you were going to stop and you were going to watch. So yeah. when you see Christie spar, like I say, with Chris Eubank, the sparring that I saw, I'm not saying that it always worked out this way, but the sparring that I saw, Christie always got the better of it. I'm not saying it happened all the time, but the times that I saw, Christie got the better of it. Don't get me wrong, Eubank gave as good as he got, but Christie would always have that final word, always.
Yeah, Errol Christie was something else. And unfortunately, he couldn't, because Don Davis used to train him, remember that?
That's right, yeah, Don.
He couldn't, he didn't convert it into a professional. But the thing about it is this, is fighters knowing it. We know it. And it was a special talent, man. A very brilliant.
Sadly, a lot of top amateurs don't make good professionals. And if you look at my brother Dudley as a prime example, Dudley won everything as an amateur. Dudley's a four-time schoolboy champion. Dudley was a four-time schoolboy champion. A junior ABA champion twice, an ABC champion. Dudley went to the first world championships in Yokohama in Japan in 1979. I've still got the bag. I've still got his bag that he took with him. I've still got that, the original bag that he got from Yokohama. Dudley had six professional fights, won his first four, and then he lost to a guy from Finland, which I thought was just bad management. Then he lost to James Cook. And Dudley just walked away from the sport. He was sick of it. He just had enough of it. Dudley was like a pro when he was an amateur. Dudley was doing things like a professional from a very, very young age. And I just think it was a quite classic case of too much, too soon, too quick. It all happened to Dudley very, very quickly. And had Dudley been managed by Mickey Duck, I've got no doubt Dudley would have been at least a European, maybe a who knows. Who knows? You know, I'm not sure. Who knows?
So, Duke, let me move on to the hold on. We got a Snapchat blessing. I put hold on from Jermaine Gordon. Thank you for the donation, sir. He said, blessings upon you, Tun Spence. Enough respect. Thank you very much, my man. So, Duke, we're moving on to the second world title at bantamweight. And I remember this fight because it was on ends, it was at Elephant and Castle.
Yeah,
and I remember coming in. bowled into the ring to MC Hammers, you can't touch this.
That's it.
And a lot of people don't realize that at that time, fighting for the belt, you was aiming to become the first fighter this century to win world titles in two different weight classes.
Yeah.
And again, it's like, it's almost as though...
The last man being Bob Fitzsimmons. Let's get that one
And it's almost as though, for some reason, I mean, listen, I'm not throwing aspersions or whatever, but it's almost as though certain people are trying to write this out of history. Because the young one, they're not going to know this unless they choose the fight is right. They're not going to know that. They're not knowing that you were setting these records. You have to go back 100 years, not 10, not 20, not 50, 70 or 90, 100 years. And well, I just feel, I said to Spencer, sorry, Duke, I said to Spencer.
No, listen, it's 104 years, let's get it right. And, you know, when, I'll just give you the backdrop on the Canizales fight. So, do you remember Screen Sport? There used to be a program on TV called Screen Sport back in the day. We used to show all the boxing. I woke up one night about, for argument's sake, for about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I just happened to turn the television on. And it had Gabby Canizales fighting Miguel Laura for the WBO Bantamweight Championship of the World. As I saw the fight, as the fight started to unfold, and Canizales got bounced off the canvas, then he got up and he absolutely destroyed Miguel Laura. I'd actually been offered the Miguel Laura fight about a year previous, but I turned it down. And the reason I turned it down was simply because I don't like boxers. I like guys that want to fight. Miguel Laura was a beautiful boxer. I mean, he had every move and some. And I would have had to have gone to Miami to fight him as well, and I didn't really fancy that. Anyway, long and short it was, Canizales went over there and smashed him to pieces. I rung Mickey Duff that morning at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and the phone only rang once, and Mickey Duff was watching the fight. And he said to me, I've just seen Gabby Canizales knock out Miguel Laura. He said, dude, he said, I've seen it. He put the phone down. And I thought we had a bad connection. And then so I rang him back. Yeah, I said, honest to God, true. I rang him back. I said, Mickey, I've just seen Miguel Laura knock out, I've just seen Gabby Canizales knock out Miguel Laura. He said, dude, he said, I'm on to Manny Stewart now. I'm going to make the fight. Listen, I had no reason to doubt Mickey Duff, and anything Mickey Duff said to me previously, it always delivered. And he had also said to me that the only reason that before the Canizales fight, I had the fight, what I call the fight of my life, against Terry Jacob for the European Bantamweight World title in Calais. The only thing that let me down over there basically was a little bit of inactivity, and it was my first fight up at Bantamweight. However, the tactics that Jacob used to beat me, I used to beat Canizales. If you watched Canizales fight, I set a really quick pace.
There's no
power on my punches whatsoever. I'm just throwing lots of shots. That's how I can double and triple the jab. There's no power on it, but Canizales don't know that. And when you've got a guy that just keeps coming forward, they're walking on to that. So all you've got to do is you just got to aim it right and pick them up. Every time they come in, you switch your shot. Every time they step off, you switch your shot. Do you see what I mean? So if you watch the Canizales fight, you'll see every time he moves and adjusts the thrower shot at me, I hit him with jab. If I've done it in one jab, I hit him with two. If I've done it with two, I hit him with three. There's always two or three on the way because he's a flat-footed fighter, Canizales. Very, very strong, physically a lot stronger than me. So I knew that if I stood still, I ran the risk of probably getting knocked out. So I trained like a dog for the fight. I left no stone unturned. And when we get to the weigh-in, and Canizales says to me, he's bad-mouthing me, and what he's telling me he's going to do, I'm going to knock you out, you're this, you're that, blah, blah, blah. All I could think to say to him was, if you've missed one day's training, I said, I'll find you out. I said, because the last 3 months, I've been outside my front door unless I'm going to the gym. Yeah, unless I'm going to the gym or I'm going to my bed. They're the only 2 times I'm going out my front door. And right then and there was a look in his eyes, and he knew he had a fight on his hands. Now, I'm not saying he took me lightly. I don't think he took me lightly, but he just couldn't catch me because I was so fit. I mean, once I'd lost my flyweight world title to Dave McCauley, my 6 mile runs went to 8 mile runs. My 8 mile runs went to 10. My 10 mile runs went to 15 mile runs. I used to do a 15 Saturday, a 15 on a Sunday, because it was like I had to. It was like I was almost like I had to start again. But I wasn't actually starting again. I was just picking up from where I left off. After I lost to Dave McCauley, he said to me, "You're finished. You're never going to be the same." But I knew the reasons why I lost to McCauley. And nobody else knows this, but I'll tell you now. I'm not making an excuse, but 2 weeks before Dave McCauley, my brother Dudley got married in Barbados. I went to Barbados with Dudley. I'm his best man. Dudley didn't say to me, I'm getting married in ABC. Dudley said to me, little man, I'm getting married in Barbados. He said, I need you there. I'm not about not to go. I was his best man. Like, Dudley was my best man for when I got married. And so 2 weeks before the McCauley fight, after I got back from Barbados, I'm like a stone and 4 pound overweight. So now I'm not fighting for McCauley. I'm fighting to do the weight. So when we got to the weigh-in, the official weigh-in, I'm still a pound overweight, which I had to skip off. And when Mickey Duff saw me at the official weigh-in for the McCauley fight, he said to me, he said, F me, F you, man. He said, you look like a black pair of braces. Right then and then, I knew the fight was lost. Because if Mickey Duff didn't have confidence in me, I didn't have confidence in me. Do you see what I mean? And all I kept saying to myself was, because I was hurt early in that fight. The McCauley fight, I was hurt, I think, in the first round. He hurt me with a shot. All I kept saying to myself was, I can't let this guy knock me out. I just can't. I knew the title had gone, but I've gone into survival mode. From round two, watch the fight. I'm in survival mode. I'm not letting my hands go. I'm barely surviving. I'm just trying to stay out of the way because I know the title's gone and because I don't want to get knocked out. So, but the lesson that I learned, like I say, in the McCauley fight, and I knew that wasn't me. So going into the Canizales fight now, Mickey Duff would always said to me, a happy fighter's a good fighter. So once I started doing my tick box, did I train right? Was I going to bed right? Did I eat right? Did I sleep right? Did I make the right sacrifices? I mean, there wasn't anything I could go, I didn't do or I didn't have. Everything was just on point. So had Canizales had beaten me, it wouldn't have been because I wasn't ready or I wasn't prepared. I was more than ready and prepared. But like I say, that was my career's best performance, but not my hardest fight.
Okay. Bobby Wright for the $4.99 donation. He says, Tris Dixon, better watch out. This is real boxing life story. Big up, Mr. MBE. Now, big up Bobby Wright. He's actually a serviceman in the army, and he always supports us, and he always defends us from all of these internet trolls. So he's a real one. Now, trust me, he's absolutely a real one. This is what I want to know. Is when your brother Dudley got married and you went out 2 weeks before the fight,
yes.
Do you regret doing that? Because it always seems to me you don't regret it. All right, but because of the weight that you're very tall for being a flyweight.
Listen, I'm 5'7", and for a flyweight that's pretty tall. But here's the thing: Dave McCauley is 5'7½". The difference between me and McCauley was that obviously he trained for me like that was the last fight he was ever going to have. Now, when I looked at his resume, his CV, Dave McCauley had been on the deck 17 times. I thought to myself, all I have to do is show up. Maybe that's it. Listen, I got a little bit cocky and I paid the price because I took my eyes off the price. Do you see what I mean? However, if I had to do it again, I would, because I wasn't about to let my brother down. Do you understand?
But
having said that, it done me a favour, because moving to bantamweight was the best thing I'd ever done. Because if I hadn't have got beat by McCauley, I would have stayed at flyweight and tried to make the weight again. And because you do, you try to make it again and again and again. Because all the time you're successful, you never question yourself. If you knew what I was actually living off for the last probably 8 to 10 months after the McCauley fight, in the run-up to the McCauley fight, trying to make weight, I had a few blackouts because I was, so dehydrated, one thing and another. Listen, I'm not making any real excuses. He beat me, but he didn't beat the best me. Do you see what I mean? He didn't beat the best Duke McKenzie. I arguably went on to beat probably better fighters. You can't tell me Dave McCauley's better than Gabby Canizales or Cesar Soto or Jesse Benavidez. But it is listen, it is what it is. That's life. But that's not I look.
Your European title challenge against Jakub, you didn't lose that fight. I don't care that you're not Danny. You didn't lose that fight. You mean no? You did not lose that fight. I don't care. You was a foreign opponent. You was boxing his ears off, and you got to think about it. You boxing his ears off up to round 9, right? You get floored. Yeah. You got up.
Yeah.
You still. And I think if that fight was anywhere else, that fight anywhere, it could have been in Italy. And you know you got to knock him out to get a draw. You'd have still won that fight.
Well, listen, like I say, that was the fight of my life because that fight really showed me what character was all about. I'd never been decked before, Spencer, going into that fight. I'd never been hit in a fight before and actually wanted to quit. Now, I get back to my corner at the end of the 11th round. My chin's gone down. I'm hurt, and I'm hurting all over because this guy's just he's had his way with me for the last 2 or 3 rounds. And my chin's gone down. Mickey Duff lifts my chin with one finger, and he says to me, "Mackenzie, I won't swear, but you can imagine what he said. He said, if you effing quit, he said, you'll be eating your dinner by candlelight for the rest of your days. He said, show some character, get out there. He said, fight. He said, you can still win this. Now, I knew Mickey Duff knew I couldn't win that fight. But what Mickey Duff was looking for was character. He was looking for me not to swallow like I wanted to. And I went out there and I took my beatings. And after every fight I ever had, Mickey Duff, he'd come back to my hotel room and he'd be gone straight away. You know, Mickey Duff stayed with me for pretty much half that night, just speaking to me, telling me how he was going to bring me back and how he was going to get me another world title fight. So when the Canizales fight came around second time, I was more than ready because Jakub had showed me what I needed to do to become a world champion again. Do you see what I mean? So
yes.
I used all that experience from that fight I took to the Canizales fight. And that fight, like I say, the Canizales fight was the fight of my life. It's the best performance of my life by now.
Listen, I mean, I can listen. Before we move on to your third, you know, world title against Benavidez, tell me something. I'm listening to you, dude. You know, you're well spoken, you're articulate, you know, very well mannered. I mean, very coherent. And for someone with so many fights, you know, you've said it. You've been decked. You've got back up. Do you feel that it was your dedication to the sport that has allowed you to have a career after boxing? Because we know that, you know, you to be honest with you should be on TV today. Because, I mean, there's a fight coming up with Carl Frampton and challenging for his third world title. I don't think there's no one better qualified, more qualified to give commentary on that contest than you. So maybe the Fight Is Right listeners can send their postcards into BT Sports because we need Duke up there giving the real commentary because he's been there, got the T-shirt and done it. But
I'm going to tell you something. Since we're on this subject, right?
Go
ahead. And while we're talking, Ed Robertson, who's now the head senior guy down at Sky, just sent me a message like checking on my well-being. It's cool. But I do remember Duke applying to a TV company. I'm not going to say what TV station it was. And while he applied to the TV station, right, for doing the boxing, the senior person in there, this is about 10 years ago, the senior person in there said, for Duke Mackenzie, the former three-weight world champion, former British and European champion, to send his CV into them. Are you hearing me? You heard me, Tundi.
Disrespect. Hey, the disrespect. It should have sent it to me. It should have sent it to me. I would have gone down there and fly kicked the man who's giving out the jobs. The disrespect out to the three-way world champion, the first man in 100 years to win a two-weight world. And you're asking me for your CV. But I know you've got boys on TV now. They couldn't even qualify to do the fight. The price is right. We don't never know the fight is right. The fight is right. We got the price is right. But to ask the one and only Drew McKenzie MB for a CV shows me that the people employing people really, it seems like it's favoritism. Because you better to do a job than someone who's walked it, lived it. And as I say, one of the reasons why I brought this thing up is because you speak so well, Duke. You know, there are not many retired fighters today that can really just reel off their career and the experiences that they've had in the sport as beautiful as you. So I don't know. Maybe they just want us to start talking like I mean you talk, Ben. Then we might get a job. We might get a job.
Yeah, for real. I'm disappointed obviously not to have done more media TV work, but listen, if you've got a team and you're happy with that team, you're going to stick with that team. And
You're just being out there because your opinion is so valid, especially to like, and I'm surprised that you haven't started training fighters or being involved with fighters. I know like you got your gym where you're dealing with training like people want to keep fit and white collar people and stuff like that. But I'm saying not exactly for you to be the trainer per se because you're running your own business, but just you being that old wise head in the corner, just to whisper in someone's ear, because you know so much. You was around in the era when it was about the technicalities. It was about fine tuning things. It was about the little sneaky stuff. You know what I mean? So I think you'd be very valuable to anybody in this game. Go on.
I beg you don't mash up my thing, because after this, I'll be on the phone. Don't try to give everybody my link. I'm on the phone straight after this. Don't worry about that. So, Spencer is telling the truth, and I'm saying I'm sitting there listening to you, Duke, and I'm saying that soon as the next fight comes up with me and Mr. Yard, I've got two knowledges now. I've got Duke McKenzie and I've got Spencer Fearon. Because, listen, man, and again, you know, if a lot of the young people watching this show and watching Duke, listen to how he speaks about the sport of boxing so humbly. Listen how he talks about the fighting and, you know, and these are the, you know, I think it was Brother Hopkins said that there's no teachers left in the sport of boxing today.
Nope. Yeah, that's exactly what he said.
You know, there's no teachers. Spencer knows me. Regardless of what people say about me, there's only a few people that know me. And I'm a student. I study. I make a lot of noise, but Spencer knows. I study. That's why my first ever corner was with Spencer Fearon's last fight, which was a championship fight. So as a trainer, I came in at a championship.
Is he commentating on?
Yeah. I remember that.
I remember.
It's so funny how all three of us are meeting up again, so I don't think that's a coincidence. But you know, Duke, I just feel that you've got so much knowledge, and I hope today, and let me just reiterate that there is a 10% fee that me and Spencer will be taking from you if you do get that job.
I don't know where Duke lives. I'll just turn up at his house.
Because
anyone that comes on our show, as soon as they come on our show, the world changes for them. There's the energy.
Really?
Like, I was looking today, I was like, hold on, Duke ain't got no blue tick on Insta. He ain't got no blue tick on Twitter. What is going on? Like, what are they? Like, that's what I'm trying to say. I feel so passionate about, you know, highlighting people like yourself and Trevor Curry. And there's many others who I'm quite sure, along minor Spencer's sojourn in this thing, that we're going to be highlighting. Otherwise, there's going to be a whole generation, maybe even two generations, of young people that don't know Duke McKenzie. Realize what he's achieved in the sport of boxing and how much knowledge he has to share. So, you know, listen, man, I could go on, but we're going to go on to your third.
Before you go on to his third world title.
Yes.
Duke McKenzie beats Cesar Soto.
Yes.
Cesar Soto was serious. Cesar Soto was a serious, tough guy. Rough. Hit you with everything. Elbows, head. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I saw him fight Victor Rabanales in a real, it was a life and death fight. Because these are two Mexican guys, you know, fighting on like a Mexican day in Mexico. And when I say these guys just went head to head for 12 rounds, they went head to head. Sorry, for 10 rounds, they went head to head. And they just knocked lumps out one another. And it was a toss up as to which one I was going to fight at one point. But obviously Soto got the victory. So he became, I think, my, he wasn't my mandatory. He wasn't my mandatory at all. I actually picked Cesar Soto to fight because he was quite flat footed. And it was a good fight. It was a hard fight. And he kept me on my toes. But, you know, ultimately, I was just a little bit too slick for him on the night. It was, it was one of them fights really that I could draw on my whole wealth of experience that I had. You know, before I boxed him, you know, I look back at the Bahol fight, I look back at the Jacob fight, I look back at one or two, you know, the Magri fight, you know, and put all these together to beat him. Do you see what I mean? You never stop learning, and you know, you learn on the job. And it was one of them fights where he knew there was only one way he was gonna beat me, and that's just by putting pressure on me. But in doing so, he kind of fell into a bit of a trap because, you know, towards the end of the fight, certainly, I was hitting him a lot more cleanly with my jab and picking him up, just like you say, little uppercuts and hooks on the inside as well, and trying to turn him, just kept trying to offset him. And he's like, if he hit me once, I try to hit him twice. You know, it was my old sort of game, my old sort of school game that I used to play with all these guys and just do different things, but in a similar fashion, if you see what I mean. But it worked out.
And I've always heard you speak so highly of Mickey Duff. You know, every time I hear you mention that guy's name, I can hear the admiration in your voice for the guy. But tell me how important Mickey Duff was to your career, and what is having the right manager absolutely imperative?
Again, if I draw a parallel to my career, my brother Dudley's career, if Dudley would have had Mickey Duff, Dudley would have been a British European, possibly even a world champion, because Mickey Duff had a very unique way. If Mickey Duff liked you, he liked you. If he didn't like you, he would still do business with you, because Mickey Duff's, one of his famous sayings used to be, you know, you can still do business with somebody but not like them. You can still pay somebody a lot of money. You can still pay them money. You don't have to like them, but it's purely business. So what Mickey Duff gave me, probably 80% of his fighters never had what he gave me in terms of his personal time. Now, I'm 19 years old. I'm unemployed. I'm scratching around. When I asked Mickey Duff to manage me the first time, he turned me down point blank. He wouldn't do it. He just wouldn't, because he didn't live in his country. But he did it in such a lovely way. I used to ring him long distance, call him collect in America. So he answered the phone, and he had to pay for it. And this went on for about 6 to 8, 10 months, possibly even a year. I used to ring him all the time in America. And I used to wait for him. When he used to come back from America and to go to his office at Wardour Street, I used to wait at his office. I used to turn up there before he even got there. And I'd wait for him all day. Sometimes he wouldn't even show up. But one day, after about 3 or 4 months, I'd been going pretty much every day. I befriended all of these backroom staff. I didn't know what I was doing. I had nothing on my hands except time. I used to go down to his office. It was like a day out for me. I'd go down there. I'd wake up in the morning. I'd have a shower. I'd have my breakfast. I'd put on a clean pair of trousers and a shirt. I'd go to the West End. I'm 19 years of age. And I'd go down to his office. I'd see people like Archie Kessler, Davy Jones. Mickey Duff's secretary was a lady called Eileen. And he had another one called Val and Jill, and I ended up being like a little errand boy. I used to make these people cups of teas. I'd wait around all day waiting for Mickey Duff to turn up. He'd never turn up. I'd talk to Archie Kessler for hours. Denny Mancini was always down there. Everybody liked me. Everybody sort of welcomed me in. And Eileen particularly, Mickey Duff's, his sort of head secretary, she seemed to really take a bit of a shine to me. She was like, well, don't worry, Duke. You know, he's going to be coming. And he never did. But when he, you know, she'd always sort of like make me feel welcome. And I'll never forget the conversation. One day she rang me up, she said to me, dude, she said, Nikki's gonna be here. She said, make sure you're here at ABCD time. And I was there like 2 hours before. I was just made sure I was there. And in the minute Mickey Duff made eye contact with me, he shook my hand and he sort of said to me, "What, you again?" Because I'd rung him so many times in America, it was like we'd struck up a long-term, long-distance relationship. And he said, "What, you again?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "It's me again, Mick." I said, "I want you to manage me." He said, "Didn't I tell you yesterday I can't manage you?" I said, "Yeah, but, you know, listen." I said, "I'm here." I said, "You might as well manage me." But he wouldn't have it. And this is where my luck really, really changed with Mickey Duff. And he had Kelvin Smart, who was the British flyweight champion at the time. And Kelvin Smart was sparring at Thomas Beckett. And Mickey Duff had arranged me to do a couple of rounds with him. So I went down to the Thomas Beckett. I borrowed somebody's gloves. I didn't have my own sparring gloves. I borrowed somebody's gloves. And Kelvin Smart just come flying at me. And I literally shut my eyes. And I think I threw like a left hook. And I ended up shattering his nose or breaking his nose. Total fluke. If I tried it again, it would never happen. And in the space of about an hour, there was a call from Mickey Duff's office. And he went, "Duke," he said, I said, "Mick," I said, "what do you want?" He said, "Duke," he said, "come to my office." I said, "what do you want?" He said, "Duke," he said, "come to my office." And I went to his office. He said, "there's a contract on the table." He said, "sign it." And that was it. I never looked back.
No lawyer.
And you know, 48 hours after that had happened, Mickey Duff had rung me back again. He said to me, "there's a ticket at Heathrow Airport." He said, "pick it up." He said, "your next fight's going to be in Vegas." And I went to Vegas. And that's where I met Bozo Edwards. That's where I met
Bozo fighting Hector Camacho. I see you walking out with Bozo.
Did you see me? Listen. I can't tell you how many times Mickey Duff, at least half a dozen times, Mickey Duff says to me, "Duke, there's a ticket at Heathrow. Duke, there's a ticket at Gatwick." When he got Bozo Edwards to fight against Hector Camacho, Mickey said to me, "you can be the bucket boy." I'm like 20 years old, right? With the fights in Miami, And I'm literally walking to the ring with Bozo Edwards carrying the bucket with one hand. Yeah. And I'll never forget the experience. The emotion I felt on that, I felt so special on that day. Because I've been in Vegas for about 3 weeks at this time, and we've been going to Johnny Tocco's gym in downtown Vegas, and it was, I don't know if you remember, when they did it like a round robin, there was like Edwin Rosario, Livingstone Bramble, Hector Camacho, Bozo Edwards, right? They were all fighting one another. So Bramble fought Rosario, and Bozo fought Camacho. So I'd go down to Johnny Tocco's gym at like 8 o'clock in the morning. Rosario would walk in and do his workout. Edwin Rosario left, Livingstone Bramble came in, did his workout. Bramble would leave, Camacho would come in with his firm, do his workout. He'd leave, Bozo Edwards would come in, do his workout. It was like being a kid in a sweet shop. And also, you know what it's like on fight week when all the big boys come in, like Evander Holyfield, like Sugar Ray Leonard, Marvin Hagler. Honestly, it was like a real who's who. All the big boys were there. And I was, Evander Holyfield. Do you know Evander Holyfield spoke to me when I was about, Pernell Whitaker was there. Listen, I'm proper on one now. Right, these guys were there. I was privileged to speak with some of these guys because I was just in awe of all of these guys. And I can remember speaking to like Sweet Pea for about an hour or two. Evander Holyfield was the best because he actually knew my name. So I don't know who had given him that info on me. But Evander Holyfield, he gave me a lot of, just a lot. He spoke to me like I was his brother. Do you see what I mean? But I watched him for about a good hour after we'd spoke, and at the weigh-in for the fight. And Evander Holyfield was just walking around talking to people, just everyday people, like he knew everybody. He was just a lovely, warm, beautiful human being. And like I say, I was privileged to all of this. I was exposed to all of these guys at a really early age. It was like I was like a sponge, just soaking it all up. And I suppose in some ways I sort of failed my way to success because, as you know, I was a really poor amateur. But by the time I sort of turned professional, the experiences that I was getting, the people that I was meeting, I was going to win something. Yes. Whether that be a southern area, whether that be a southern area or a British, a European, or as it was at World Championships, the experiences that I was getting was setting me up. Do you see what I mean? Because I've always kept saying to me, he'd always say to me, your time's going to come. Have patience. Now, when you're 21, you think you're world champion. So when you're on the rise and you've got this unbeaten record, you think you're a world champion long before you get there. And Mickey Duff kept saying to me, have patience, just be patient. I couldn't see it at the time, but as it started to unfold, I just had to take a step back, just have patience, and, you know, look who it's got me.
Fantastic. Come on, before we touch on
the third world title now, Duke. The third world title.
Yes, and that was against
Jesse Benavidez.
Yep.
And I remember that because that was
Spence. He ain't paid his electric bill, Duke. Don't worry about that. But 15th of October 1992, you become a three-weight world champion, beating Jesse Benavidez after 12 rounds for the WBO Super Bantam title. Tell us all about it and how you felt. And before I say that, you was actually a four-weight champion, a regional champion, because you won a title at regional level, a British title at February.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And that speaks volumes, coming up from, you know, from a fly and all the way to featherweight. But hold on, Joe Farmer, we've got to say, Joe Farmer says, Duke, who are you inspiring or training now? Who, in your opinion, should we be on the lookout for?
Who should we look out for? There's and only one word. Sorry?
Are you training anyone presently?
No, I'm not. I don't train boxers per se. I love to train anybody. I love to train anybody. I like to get people fit. I like to give them the boxing experience, the boxing knowledge, if you will. But listen, I'm like most people. I quite like Gervonta Davis, because Gervonta Davis isn't just a puncher. People have got it so twisted. They think all he does is just goes and knocks people out. He's so much more than that. That kid can actually box, and I like him. And I think he'll be the last man standing at the current four champions.
Yes.
You know, for me, he beats everybody at lightweight, junior lightweight.
Yes, yes. Sorry to interrupt you, because this guy's paying for this comment. So he says, stamina for so lands in the camp fighters of love. Two in a row between Yard and Bilal. Yard done lost two of his last four fights. Tundi, did you get fired by Yard yet? Well, I'll answer that. First of all, I'll let Anthony answer that question. But on that question, Duke, do you think that people are written off too soon after a defeat nowadays? I mean, I was at Johnny Nelson on the show the other day. And he had 12 defeats on his record. Yeah. But he ended up being the longest reigning cruiserweight champion, I think, Spencer, in history.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like nowadays, you lose one fight or two fights and you're written off. And what do you have to say about that, Duke?
Listen, it is wrong, because the fights you lose often make you. The fights you lose often shape your character. The fights you lose often tell you who you are and what you need to do to go on to become better than where you were. So it's not really a question of, you shouldn't go unbeaten in like 10, 15, 20, 30 fights, because that's not doing you any favours. It's always good to take a hit, I believe. You know, if you get beat early in your career, great. But, you know, if you get beat after like 10, 15, 20 fights, even better still, because that will really shape somebody's character. That tells you a lot about the fighter. So if this guy is specifically referring to you and your guy there, Sunday, you know, your guy should come back better than what he was. And if you look at where he was, if you look at where he was to where he is now, he knows what it is to lose now. And he'll also know that he can't leave fights to be, it was a close fight, and you can't leave it that close.
Yeah.
You got, you know, when you're in that final third, you've got to start pulling away.
Yeah. And not only that, Duke, you know, again, it's so great to hear it from a man who's done it. A lot of these people that come, and the only reason why I put up his question, because he's paid for it. it's a good thing nowadays, mate. If you want to criticize someone, we pay for it. So I love this platform. But, you know, again, you know, just talking about Ant had 12 amateur fights, and he lost to arguably the best light heavyweight, you know, in Russia. No, we went over to Russia, you know, and he's got to where he's got meteoric, really, and he's got a lot to learn, and we never had the amateur experience, you know. We never had 12 amateur fights. So I never really listened to people like that, because I know that the story ain't over. We, you know, it's just begun. As you said, he's in the embryonic stage of his career, and he's still got a long way to go. But I just, you know, it ain't about me or the team, but the fact that he's paid for it to get that question up there, I thought it'd be good. You're a good person to ask that question. But as I said, moving on to the final world title, Spencer was about to say something before he got cut off. Spence, touching it against Jesse Benavidez. Can you hear me, Spence? You're mute, Spence. You're mute.
Sorry, my apologies there, gentlemen.
Yes.
Back. Yeah.
We were saying that, you know, you were just about to touch on the Benavidez.
The Jesse Benavidez fight. I remember this. Because I remember when the fight took place. And I remember Gary Mason, God rest his soul, he went on a big rant about the lack of support that you got from the press.
Hold on. Didn't Gary Mason have a guy to win?
Yeah. And he went on a big rant. I think Fabonical went there. I mean, I can speak ill of the dead. Gary's my friend, man.
I'm just saying that because I was watching it last night. There goes to Gary, you know, and he's like, yeah, I don't, you know, they ain't giving Duke the credit he deserves. And then the commentator goes, so who do you think's gonna win the fight, Gary? And he goes, well, I'm gonna say Benavidez. And I'm like, come on, man. What's going on here? But anyway, that's another story.
But you know what? That was a great win.
Well, listen,
Sorry, go on, Duke.
Well, I was going to say, you know, the Benavidez fight was that fight for me. The difference between me and Jesse Benavidez was where he made his mistake was, to him, it was just another paycheck. You know, given the fact that I'd lost the Bantamweight world title under the circumstances that I had, losing to Rafael Del Valle in a round. And it, to him, it was just a paycheck. And when you look at Jesse Benavidez, his record, his resume, he was, I think he'd only lost once in about 36. WBA champion, former WBA champion. He'd beaten the former WBO champion. He was ranked number one by the Ring magazine. And he was absolutely on a roll, you know, Kronk fighter, ABCD. So he thought all he had to do was turn up. My train of thought was going into the fight was, this is going to be my last fight, and if I can't beat him, then there's no tomorrow, there's no way back for me. So I was prepared just to leave everything I ever had, you know, my whole soul and spirit. I was prepared to leave it in that ring, which is what I did on that night, because I couldn't even walk out of that ring after the fight. I was so elated, and it was like someone had really pulled the rug from underneath my feet, because I was just so deflated after the fight. And like I say, because I left everything in there. But if you watch the fight, I get a little bit of luck, because Lady Luck shines on me. I think we're going into the 10th round. I make the fight. I think I'm one round down with two to go. But if you look at the fight, at the beginning of the 11th round, I throw a straight right and a left hook. My foot is clearly behind his foot. He trips over, but the referee doesn't see it. He just sees the punches. Now it's a 10-8 round to me with one round to go. So now I'm one round up with one round to go. All I say to myself is, if I can win the last round, I might get this. I might get this, because I think I've won now by two rounds. And I win the last round. So in my own mind's eye, one of the judges is going to give me the fight. If they scored it like how I had scored it, then I've won it by two rounds, which one of the judges did. One judge gave it to me by two rounds. I think another one gave it to me by three rounds. Another one, I don't know what fight he was watching, gave it to me by eight rounds, but that's for another day. Yeah. But like I say, it was a pleasing fight. When I look now,
we're getting a bit of feedback there. We're getting a bit of feedback. I don't know if you move your computer screen or.
Is that okay?
Right. Yeah, we can hear you now. We can hear you.
I don't really listen. The Benavidez fight was my most rewarding fight, my most pleasing fight, the fight that gives me more satisfaction than any of my other fights that I had previously, because that fight has set me up to be, in British boxing terms, a history maker. And when all said and done, you know, when you look back in British boxing history, my name's going to be right up there. And that's something which gives me tremendously proud, not only as a boxer, but as a person. You know, like I say, I have the worst amateur pedigree, certainly of any professional world champion. And when I look back on it now, one's a sport, the other's a profession. My style was obviously suited better for the professional game as opposed to the amateur game.
Yes. Spence?
Listen, man. Drew McKenzie was just one of the guys who, I think I was about 13 years old, and I got to move around with Drew McKenzie at the Thomas Abeke. I remember going in and telling all my mates at school, yeah, I was sparring with Drew McKenzie. I didn't even know who Drew McKenzie was, right? And then after that, Duke got elected. He was in the Ring magazine. He was like number 5 in the Ring magazine. So this is before Duke became then the European champion. And I remember, like, I always religiously, I bring the Ring magazine into my class. And then, like, one of the kids looks at Duke McKenzie, rah, he's number 5 in the Ring magazine. He's going nuts. And then from there, I was a little star at school. Because, like, I was very fortunate as a little kid to just move around. He's like, yeah, come and got. Except Thomas Abeke, I got to move around with Duke McKenzie. At that time, Colin McMillan was. I used to watch Colin McMillan and Duke McKenzie spar. I'm telling you, you'd pay money to watch that sparring. You'd pay money to watch that sparring. And not it was like the thing what got, apart from you becoming world champion, but just before you becoming world champion, it was the Pearly train crash. And the Pearly crash, what was it? It was like, I think like 5 people died, but loads of people got injured.
That's right.
And then it happened, the crash was in Duke's back garden. And I remember Duke being on Terry Wogan.
Yeah.
That was a big thing, you know, to be on Terry Wogan. Terry Wogan.
That was a big show.
It was a big BBC show. I remember Duke come on there. It was like, yeah, well, I was indoors having my tea, as you do. And I look out the window. So I just dropped all my keys. I binge running down my mouth. I run out to try to help people. So people are Duke was a hero. Duke was a hero.
Let me see. You know, the only person who does a better person is my anyone who does is I tell you that impersonation is fantastic, John. That was a real boy. Thanks for that, Spence. I really appreciate it, champ.
Listen, ladies and gentlemen. Let me close it off properly, because for myself, you know, this has literally been such an educational episode of The Fight Is Right, and you know, I said to Spence, and Spence said to me, the name of Duke McKenzie. As long as we've got something to do about it, or do with it, we're never going to forget you, Duke, because you're a legend of the sport. You're a legend of British boxing. And I think my one wish is that after this goes out on air, on YouTube, that some of these TV companies really pick up, because I just feel that just the way you speak about boxing, the knowledge that you have to give of the sport, it is needed. Some of these commentators, what I'm seeing on, and these guys, what they got on TV, no disrespect, they are where they are, but I just feel that they can't give us the real perspective of the sport, because they haven't done it. You know, you got the t-shirt, you've done it. And let's hope the phone rings for you, Duke, after this. And they give you that slot, whether it's BT, Sky Sports, ITV, The Zone. The Zone seems to be handing out all the checks. So we need Duke McKenzie on The Zone.
Exactly.
But for me, Tunde Ajayi, for myself, Tunde Ajayi, Duke, I'm honoured. And one of the sentences I'm taking away from this show is you saying there is nothing to fear but fear itself. Ladies and gentlemen, Duke McKenzie. Spence, sign him off how you want to sign him off, mate.
Listen, been a plum pleasing pleasure to have the freeweight world champion, the legendary Duke McKenzie. And I got to big up Duke even more that I know that his parents were from Clarendon, Jamaica, the exact birthplace and burial place of my old man. So big up Duke McKenzie for that. Yes, Dream it, believe it, become it. Yeah, sign us off, brother Baba Tunde Ajayi.
Oh man, I don't want to sign it off because Duke, have you got any last words before we sign it off?
Yeah, listen, I have actually. You know, if you hang around the barber shop long enough, you're going to get a haircut, right? So, with a little bit of luck, listen, I love talking about the sport of boxing. I love to give people what I've learned over a 17-year career, and you know. Listen, I love it. It's what I do. It's who I am. And if I get an opportunity to work for any of the networks, then listen, I'll take it. Of course, I will.
Yes, sir.
But I want to say thank you, Spencer. I appreciate you, Tunde. I appreciate you too. Thank you very much for inviting me on your program. It's just been you've made me relive some of the happiest times of my life. And listen. Take it away from me, and I really thank you for giving me the opportunity to express myself and talk about my career all over again.
Ladies and gentlemen, we sign off with these words. Wait. Because everyone's got glasses on apart from me, so I've got to put these on. Dream it, believe it, become it.
Come on down. Thank you very much, Duke McKenzie, for joining us on the show. Yeah, I mean, keep on doing what you're doing, little man. Take care. God bless.
Thanks, Spencer. Thanks, Tunde. I'll see you again, guys. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.